monthly review. He, I'm sorry. Now, that would be a poor joke. He developed this theory of a new bureaucratic collective class, and a theory that was in a book that was fairly popular when he wrote it, I think in the early 40s, called The Managerial Revolution, in which he explained that out of both the capitalist societies and the workers' states was evolving a whole new class of technicians, of managers, and that these were going to be the rulers of the world. He first presented that in a resolution to the party, then curiously withdrew that resolution, did not ask the party to act upon it. His analysis, his development of his theory of bureaucratic collectivism, of the managerial revolution, had nothing to do with Marxism. He was a conscious anti-Marxist. He challenged our movement on the whole question of dialectics. He was a philosophical pragmatist. And the fact that he was not a Marxist was borne out by his whole method of analysis. Marxists have a clearly thought-out conception of what constitutes a class. It was elaborated by Marx and Engels, most principally in their study of Capital. And they said that history has demonstrated that for a social grouping to constitute a class, to earn the definition of being a class, that it is necessary that they play a certain common independent role in relation to a given mode and system of production, and that it be a historically necessary role in relation to the economy, that it be a viable, historically durable formation, and that its function has some necessary relationship to the given social and property relations. Now, again, I realize that this is extremely shorthand and perhaps oversimplified, and all I want to do is to indicate to you a line of thought so that you can pursue it further. In viewing the Soviet bureaucracy and rejecting the notion that this bureaucracy constituted a class, Trotsky explained that this new formation that developed was not something that was essential to the development or the functioning of the Soviet economy, that it in fact was an excrescence thrown up by it, that it played no independent role in relationship to the economy, that it was an extremely unstable and changing force. Did not own, it had no legal rights, no rights of inheritance, of property, etc. It was a constantly shifting force. It lacked stability, it lacked viability, it lacked legality, and it lacked any necessary historical function. Now, this conception of the Soviet bureaucracy and the fact that it is not a class seems fairly apparent to our movement today, and there's very little. Occasionally, you'll get some people who hold now to the state capitalist theory, but for the most part, it's fairly apparent that the bureaucracy is that, a bureaucracy, a caste, a privileged caste, as Trotsky characterized it, and not a new class. All of the events that have demonstrated the instability of it, the centrifugal forces within it, so on, have borne that out. Half of our party in 1940 simply could not see that, even though our movement had for more than 12 years previous to that, hammered out an elaboration of the conception of the Soviet Union as a worker state in debate with all kinds of other forces, including forces within our own movement. If you go back through the early internal bulletins, you'll find all kinds of theories about the Soviet state which had to be argued out. There was Max Eastman's son, Dan Eastman. He had the theory that it was a feudal state. There were other similar theories advanced of proportionate weight, and all of them, you know, had to be discussed and answered. Our movement, so to speak, was educated on this question and seemed to be completely solid in its understanding of it. And yet, in 1940, about half our movement, about 40% of the party and about 60% of the youth movement, suddenly decided the Soviet Union is not a worker state, our whole analysis of it is incorrect, and our conclusion that it should be unconditionally defended against imperialism is equally incorrect. And here, the only way you can explain this sudden turnabout, and it happened very rapidly, in a matter of months, this whole thing developed, that people simply changed their mind about something that had been a basic part of their political thinking, can be explained only by the political climate at the time. And we have here the illustration of social forces, of particular ideologies, of alien anti-socialist ideologies penetrating and making their influence felt within the revolutionary Marxist movement. This was a period of extreme antipathy among middle-class elements generally and among radical middle-class elements particularly against the Soviet Union. I cannot recall a similar mobilization of public opinion has existed in that particular period. The only thing I can think of that gives you a faint suggestion of it is the sentiment that erupted in this country at the time of the June 1968 Mideast War, when all of a sudden, out of nowhere, there just welled up this pro-Zionist sentiment, embracing not only the Jewish community, but all sectors almost, it seemed, of the political population, beginning on the left with the exclusion of our movement, which stood firm against Zionism, all the way over to the extreme right. And that whole period during the June War, if you'll recall, if you were politically conscious then, was when the whole country just seemed unanimous in its support of the Zionist regime in Israel and in its chauvinist opposition to the Arab liberation struggle. And it was that kind of a thing, but even more deep and more widespread, that existed in 1938-39. Hitler had been in power then for some 6 years. Millions had been slaughtered in the gas chambers and the concentration camps. The unions had been smashed, the whole terrible, monstrous nightmare of fascism. At the height of all of this, Stalin, who had been conducting one blood purge after another, one show trial, one fake rigged frame-up trial after another, also killing millions, signed a political pact with Hitler. At a moment when world opinion and opinion in the United States was deeply involved with the whole question of Hitlerism and what it represented. And I remember this utterly callous and cynical and criminal indifference to public opinion expressed by this Stalinist bureaucracy in Moscow when, who the hell was it, the foreign minister toasted the German foreign minister and said fascism is a matter of taste. Well, millions of Jews and other anti-fascists in this country everywhere, they did not look very enthusiastically upon such pronouncements. This was followed by the invasion of Poland, first by Hitler and then the occupation by the Soviet Union. Military occupation of Finland by the Soviet Army. And with a big wave of propaganda built up in the press in this country about poor democratic little Finland, democratic little country that had been ruled by a butcher for decades. But they really whipped it up. Most people, what the hell did they know? I mean, it's Finland is. Paper said this was a tiny, struggling little democracy, and here this powerful Soviet Union just marched in there. It was the period of defeats for the working class, the rise of fascism in Germany. Italy had already come to power, the defeat of the Spanish Revolution, a rise of reformism in Western Europe, a big popular front movement in France, a huge reformist movement in this country under the leadership of Roosevelt, with the communist and socialist parties doing everything in their power to herd all of the radicals and the workers into this New Deal reformist movement. All of these things together created a climate where among radical intellectuals, middle class intellectuals, there was a deep revulsion against not only the Soviet bureaucracy and their crimes, but against the Soviet Union itself. And that reflected itself, that pressure, and it was an enormous pressure at the time, within the ranks of the Socialist Workers' Party, with the faction organized by Burnham, Shachtman, Ahern, reflecting and bringing that pressure into our movement. The party at that time split almost completely, not completely, but almost largely, along class lines, that is, according to the social composition of the membership. The biggest base of the opposition, which was characterized by Trotsky almost at the outset of the fight as a petty bourgeois opposition, its principal base was in the New York local of the Socialist Workers' Party, which at that time was overwhelmingly middle class in composition, and in the youth movement, the Young People's Socialist League, which again was almost overwhelmingly middle class in composition. On the other hand, the group led by Cannon, by Dunn of Minneapolis, by other leaders of the party in 1940, was almost completely, but again not exclusively, among the working class elements, the trade union activists in the party. They were under certain pressures too, the workers in the party. There was the whole pressure of the Rooseveltian reformism that was very widespread within the union movement and among many non-party union militants that they had to work with. But there was a combative spirit, at least within the union movement. This was the whole period of the rise of the CIO, the sit-down strikes, the struggles, the victories, the auto workers' victory, the rubber workers, others, and so on. And they were more impervious to this kind of middle-class public opinion. They could understand the issue better. I mentioned before the analogy with our attitude toward unions and corrupt and degenerate union leadership. Well, this was an analogy that every trade union activist in the party could very easily understand, because in 99% of the time, outside of the Minneapolis Union, a few other stray places, that was the kind of leadership that they had to put up with. And they understood from their own condition and experience of life this concept that while you're dead set against the leadership and you organize and do everything you can to mobilize the workers to get them the hell out, at the same time, obviously, despite all of the crimes of the leadership, you have to defend the union against the bosses when it's attacked by the bosses. So the working people in the party could much more easily understand this aspect of the fight. Now, when Trotsky characterized the opposition as petty bourgeois, this was not intended in any sense as a polemical epithet. Our movement in general has taken a very dim view of such methods, of political disputes. When we characterize groupings, we attempt to offer scientific characterizations, and Trotsky's characterization of the opposition as a petty bourgeois opposition was intended in precisely that way. And he was speaking not simply of the social origins of these people, because that's obviously, when you stop to think about it, not decisive. Virtually all, not all, but virtually all of the principal leaders of the Marxist movement, beginning with